this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Regions Bank is enforcing economic sanctions against our movement, against the African People's Education and Defense Fund, a nonprofit organization that does nothing but build Black power and self-determination for African people.
Black community leaders and supporters in Birmingham, Alabama, call on Regions Bank to end its racist policies and demand a payment of reparations to Black people.
Mumia is, if he's not anything, he's just a scholar, man. He's just a guy, a good dude, you know, who's being framed up.
Black Panther political prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal has been denied a new trial.
These strikes have been quietly conducted under the nose of the American public. By August 2022, a civilian harm watchdog group estimated that between 78 and 153 civilians had been killed by U.S. airstrikes in Somalia since 2007. It includes 20 to 23 children.
Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz has introduced a House resolution to withdraw all U.S. troops from Somalia.
When you have a government that actually says, we don't want democracy, we want Jewish country, Jewish state, Arabs have nothing here, this brings up to everybody the question, what is your position? Are you for democracy or are you for a Jewish country?
Trade unionists in Israel say there's no democracy without equality for Palestinians. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. On Friday, March 31st, Black community leaders and supporters held a demonstration in front of the headquarters of Regions Bank in Birmingham, Alabama, to demand an end to the bank's racist policies and call for reparations to Black people. The protest was prompted by Regions abruptly canceling all accounts and lines of credit of the African People's Education and Defense Fund and the prematurely calling in the Black nonprofit organization's mortgage loan on a property under renovation for a bakery cafe and community kitchen in an impoverished Black community in North St. Louis. This is not the first time Regions has come under criticism. They face growing community opposition for their role in funding new private prison construction in Alabama, including protests organized by the Alabama Students Against Prisons. In 2022, Regions was forced to refund $141 million to customers and pay a $50 million fee for fraudulent overdraft fees. The African People's Education and Defense Fund is a Black nonprofit organization associated with the Uhuru movement, which was the target of multi-city militarized FBI raids this summer. Uhuru leaders expect to be indicted on unfounded charges of acting as pawns of the Russian government to create dissent and influence public opinion in the U.S. Birmingham resident Kundai spoke out at Friday's protest in front of Regions headquarters.
Regions Banks wants to try to turn back the clock and hold us down. But it cannot do that because African people are fighting. Just a fight, yes. And we are winning.
Yes.
We are here to put Regions Bank and the U.S. colonial government on notice. That we represent a movement of Black working people, African people, here around the world, building, organizing for democracy and creating our own power in our own hands. We have a rising movement coming from what is ours, winning our reparations as the return of our stolen resources with the voluntary participation of many white people and the support of others within the U.S. and around the world. We're calling on you to support our struggle. Join the people's sanction of Regions Bank. Close your Regions Bank account. Withdraw your money from Regions.
Withdraw your money!
Crash this bank, literally built on the bodies of African people.
That's right.
Protest at your local Regions branch. Donate to and join the Hands Off Uhuru, Hands Off Africa defense campaign. Hands Off Uhuru!
Hands Off Africa!
Hands Off Uhuru!
Hands Off Africa!
Hands Off Uhuru!
Hands Off Africa!
Other speakers at the rally included Carolyn Lake, widow of Mufundi Lake, a black political prisoner who spent over 40 years in prison in Alabama and died there in 2018.
I am here to support the Uhuru movement, the African People's Socialist Party, and all of the entities. And I want to say that I am with you. You have been with me, my husband, my family for years and years and years. And now we're here to stand up with you. We say, this racist Regions Bank and these FBI attacks, these are not new. My family was attacked by FBI. The Sunday was attacked by FBI. And so it's nothing new to us. And so we stand with you and we know what's going on. And so we just want to say in solidarity that we are with you and you can count on us. Uhuru people!
A Birmingham resident and member of Surge, showing up for racial justice, expressed her support for the protest demands.
We just like to show themselves as the hometown hero and like to talk about all the investments that they make in the community and all the good work that they do. But we need to shine a light on the harm that they cause,
yes,
on the convict leasing, on the trustee that they are for the private prisons that are being built in Alabama.
Right on. We continue
to ask them, we continue to come to them and plead for them to stand with their values, and they continue to show us that they value capital over people, that they value power over people, and we refuse to accept this as our hometown bank, as a bank that's headquartered in Birmingham, where there has been a civil rights fight, a historical civil rights fight that continues. And we call on all people that are invested in Regions Bank to look at your investment. Is this what you want your money to go to? This is creating harm in the community, and it's preventing people from doing good work in their own communities. This is not the values that we support as white people, and this is not the values we support in Birmingham.
Friday's protest was followed by an evening teach-in. Comrade Rage introduced the historical significance of Birmingham to the Black liberation struggle.
We're here because Regions Bank is enforcing economic sanctions against our movement, against the African People's Education and Defense Fund, a nonprofit organization that does nothing but build Black power and self-determination for African people. After a 20-year relationship, Regions Bank has demanded that we close our accounts, they call in our loans due, and this is impacting our ability to continue the incredible work that we do for the African community. So again, they're taking money away from community organizations that are building for Black power and self-determination and actively participating in the genocide of African people by building plantations, building more prisons right here. This is a place where Dr. King was imprisoned. He wrote his famous letters from Birmingham jail right here. This is the place where our comrade and political prisoner, Mufundi Lake, was imprisoned and died in prison. This is the place where Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Carol Denise McNair lost their lives in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. All of this happened right here. And Regions Bank has the nerve to have their headquarters here in this sacred place. So we're saying hands off Uhuru, hands off Africa, hands off the African People's Education and Defense Fund, and stop the racist attacks by Regions Bank. We're demanding reparations now, and we're calling on community to withdraw their funds from Regions Bank. You cannot support this bank that is working to incarcerate our people and say that you care about your people.
Dr. Aisha Fields, a physicist who leads the All African Peoples Development and Empowerment Project and its disaster relief team, Black Ankh, denounced the government's attack on the Uhuru movement, of which her group is a part. She described the Black community programs impacted by region's economic sanctions.
African people know instinctively, even if we don't find ourselves in obviously political spaces, that there will be no freedom for African people without economic independence. Something on a very basic level all of us understand is that in order to be able to stand up on your own two feet, you have to be able to feed, clothe, and house yourself. In order to be in a position to determine your destiny, you have to have economic empowerment. And the African People's Socialist Party has answered that question. Under the leadership in this most recent period of Chairwoman, Deputy Chairwoman Ona Zeneya Shetela, and the African People's Education and Defense Fund, which has created businesses that are 30 plus years old that address economic development for African people, that's created incredible programs like the Black Power Blueprint, you know, that is in St. Louis, Missouri right now, dealing with the question concretely, not just theoretically, although that's important, but concretely dealing with the question of gentrification, dealing with the fact that just like we're dealing with in Huntsville, Alabama, where I live right now, where everybody's saying, come to Huntsville, it's the greatest place on earth. Well, what does that mean? When all the white people around the country come running into Huntsville, Alabama, that means all the places that used to be $315 a month to live are now $1,200 a month to live. And what Black person can afford to live in a place that once was $315 and now it's $1,200 a month to live? Right. This is the reality. When we talk about colonialism, we're not just talking about some kind of idea in the sky. This is real life for Black people. When we talk about gentrification, it's not just some word. It's a reality that destroys the lives of Black people. And this is something that the Black Power Blueprint has taken on, again, concretely. Buying up old abandoned buildings in St. Louis. I'm from Philadelphia originally, even though I live in Huntsville. And you can see that even in Philadelphia and Huntsville, everywhere, I'm sure right here in Birmingham, Black communities that look like they have been left behind, Black communities that look like they've literally been bombed out, but they're still not in the reach of many of us to purchase because we don't have the money to buy them outright. And if we do, we don't have the money to fix them up. But who does? The white developers,
right?
You know, can come and buy whole blocks
right.
in the Black community and sit on them yeah. if they want and wait until there's enough motion to be able to build this or sell that or do whatever is going to make the most money at the expense of Black people. So what has the Black Power Blueprint done? Black Power Blueprint has allowed Black people through the work of the African People's Education Defense Fund to have access to purchasing these bombed out buildings that were just a blight on our community and turn them into beautiful community spaces. Turn them into community centers like the Uhuru House, where people can have their weddings, repasses, parties, you know, a beautiful space right in the middle of your community. You don't have to go across town. You go right there to your community, to a beautiful space that you can feel proud of and that you know when you're supporting is giving back to your community. Building basketball courts. When was the last time you even saw in your city, the city building a basketball court for the babies? When was the last time you saw that? And not only a basketball court, knocked down two horrible buildings to build this beautiful state-of-the-art Black Power Vanguard's basketball court with a beautiful mural on the side, the best kind of form you can have, state of the art, beautiful. So our children don't have to play in the middle of the street. You know, old abandoned boathouse, you know, now being turned into a bakery cafe where our brothers and sisters who are coming out of prison can come and get training in culinary arts and can live in a beautiful renovated fourplex building, by the way, which is named after our brother and comrade, Mufundi Lake.
Right.
The Mufundi Lake complex is now what the African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru Movement, African People's Education and Defense Fund have built so that when our brothers and sisters come out of prison, they have a beautiful place to lay their head, they have training, they have the ability to start a new life. While what? Regions Bank takes the money that Black people and other people put into the bank to put Black people in prison.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They take this money, put Black people in prison We're working to make sure that when our brothers and sisters come out of prison, they have a future. They can come into the community and be a part of the community and help advance the community. So this attack that's been made on the African People's Education Defense Front is absolutely outrageous.
Yes.
It's outrageous. And they want to paint a picture that the Uhuru Movement, that the African People's Socialist Party, is this fringe, crazy Black people and a few crazy white people who run around talking about crazy stuff. Well, if Black people having control over our own lives is crazy, send me to Decatur General Hospital. Okay, if Black people saying that we have the right to have the resources of Africa, which is our birthright, to create a life for Black people, we're not talking about hurting nobody. We're talking about taking what belongs to us to create life for our babies,
right?
To create life for our mothers and our fathers and ourselves.
Yeah.
What is crazy about that? Unless everything you have because of that theft.
Yes. Right.
That's the only way you can be against it.
Right.
How can you be against that? How can you be against that? Unless your child going to college is because my child has to be in prison.
Right.
How can you be against that unless your home means that my children can't eat?
Right.
That's the only way you can be against that. So when we talk about these attacks, when we see these attacks and people are like, whoa, y'all, you know what? The FBI, whoa, is on y'all. Yeah, whoa, it's real. The FBI is on us. It's true.
Yeah.
It's real. It ain't nothing nice. But tell me, what the hell have we done wrong?
Right.
Tell me what we've done wrong.
African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela addressed the FBI attacks on the Uhuru Movement at the March 18th Answer Coalition anti-war march in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. On July 29th, at 5 o'clock in the morning, pre-dawn, an army of assault weapons toting, camouflage wearing, military forces identifying themselves as the FBI attacked my home. They used flashbang grenades, armored vehicles. They threatened my life and threatened my wife. They used drones. This was in St. Louis, Missouri, in the most economically depressed sector of that city. At the same time, on the white side of St. Louis, they attacked our movement, Solidarity Movement, and they used battering rams also there, knocked down doors. They held people hostage, handcuffed at gunpoint, as they did me and my wife, whom they handcuffed and zip-tied in front of our homes. They declared that despite the fact that I have been involved in fighting this system for most of the 81 years that I have been alive, despite the fact that I have opposed every predatory war that the United States, which, by the way, is the strategic enemy of all of humanity, despite the fact that I have always done that they have declared that Black people are so stupid that it takes Russians to tell us that we are oppressed. I have never known a moment of Black freedom for my entire life. I have never read of a moment since the beginning of a colonial mode of production where Black people have been free. And yet they're saying that we are agents of some foreign power because we say Black people must be free, because we say Africa must be free, because we say African people everywhere must be free. And we are here today to tell them that they don't have enough flashbang grenades in their arsenals to stop this struggle of Black people and the oppressed peoples of the world to win our freedom.
At the Birmingham Boycott Region's teach-in on Friday, Penny Hess, chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee, addressed the role of white people in the struggle for Black reparations.
The chairman Omali Yeshitela, formed the African People's Solidarity Committee all the way back in 1976, based on the strategy of the party to win everything and everyone possible to forward the goal of the liberation of Africa and African people everywhere. And our particular mission, our assignment in this revolution is to go behind enemy lines, as the chairman says, back into the white community to organize other white people just like ourselves, to be something that we've never had the opportunity to be before, which is Black power in white face, to organize for reparations to African people and to actually return the stolen resources. You know, I know that we've got to bring down this region.
Yes, we've got to do that.
Yes. That's one thing, but we have to show them that they can't do that. They can't turn back the clock. They can't take it back to a previous period when there was convict leasing. It's not like that anymore. And you know, that this is a new time, and this system is going down. It's in a crisis. And African people are building a future for all humanity and doing it absolutely on the ground.
The call to boycott Regions Bank comes after widespread public exposure of the role of the slave trade in the birth of the American banking and insurance industries, and during a time of growing demands for reparations to Black people for slavery and colonialism. For more information, visit handsoffuhuru.org. We thank the volunteers at WBPU Black Power 96.3 FM in St. Petersburg, Florida, for production assistance.
When will we be paid for the work we've done? When will we be paid for the work we've done?
We have worked this country, I'm sure, sure. Our women cooked all your food and washed all your clothes. We picked all your cotton and laid the railroad steel. Worked our hands to the bone at your lumber mill. I say,
when will we be paid for the work we've done? When will we be paid for the work we've done?
The Staple Singers, When Will We Be Paid? You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. On March 31st, 2023, Common Pleas Court Judge Lucretia Clemens denied Mumia Abu-Jamal's request for a new trial. After 43 years in prison, Black Panther and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal has exhausted nearly all of his avenues for relief. At 68 years old, Mumia is suffering from cardiac disease and has had a double bypass and nearly died from lack of treatment for acute hepatitis C. Judge Clemens stated that she was dismissing the claim of striking Black jurors on procedural grounds, dismissing Mumia's claim about the prosecutor excluding Black people from the jury without addressing the merits of the claim. Additionally, there is the note from supposed eyewitness Robert Chobert, who, after the initial trial, asked Prosecutor McGill, quote, "Where is the money that is owed to me?" End quote. This note was scrubbed from any filings and buried by the prosecution for 40 years. This dramatic Brady evidence, previously unavailable to the defense, was dismissed by the judge in her written opinion as not, quote, being material, end quote, meaning that it would not have affected the jury's verdict. It allows the ruling of the original trial court judge, Albert Sabo, who infamously said, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the N-word," end quote, to stand. Judge Clemens also dismissed records from Prosecutor McGill that extensively tracked and monitored another key witness, Cynthia White, whose pending criminal cases were all dropped by the prosecution following her testimony. Here's Mumia's grandson, Jamal Ibn Mumia Hart III, speaking on Black Power Media the day of the announcement that his grandfather would not be granted a new trial.
Heartbreaking. You know, personally, many of you know, like, he's not just some famed journalist to me. You know, that's my grandfather, right? When I look at him, I see my father, right? And, you know, Mumia is, if he's not anything, he's just a scholar, man. He's just a good dude, you know, who's being framed up by Philadelphia for a murder he didn't commit. And, you know, the judge knows this. The prosecution knows this, and it's really saddens me that they won't give my grandfather the freedom that he deserves. We will not stop because Mumia is the community. Mumia is the world movement. Mumia is the heartbeat, you know, when we talk about revolutionary, you know, thinkers. And, you know, Mumia represents all that are in prison. Mumia's story of a political prisoner is the story of your family members and your friends who are being held behind bars, you know, from a racist system. So we're not stopping, Jared. We're not stopping at all.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal's grandson, Jamal Ibn Mumia Hart III, speaking to Jared Ball of Black Power Media.
The war against us all. This war in Iraq isn't the end. It's the beginning of wars to come all around the world at the whim of the neocons in the White House. This is the Bush Doctrine come to life. War, war, and more war. War brought to you by the big corporate masters who run the show. This isn't just a war on Iraqis or Afghanis or even Arabs or Muslims. It is ultimately a war on us all. That's because the billions and billions of dollars that are being spent on this war, the cost of tanks, rocketry, bullets, and yes, even salaries for the 125,000 plus troops, is money that will never be spent on education, on health care, on the reconstruction of crumbling public housing, or to train and place the millions of workers who have lost manufacturing jobs in the past 3 years alone. The war in Iraq is, in reality, a war against the nation's workers and the poor, who are getting less and less while the big defense industries are making a killing, literally.
Immortal Technique, featuring Mumia Abu-Jamal. The war against us all. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. U.S. military engagement in Somalia has been increasing, but Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz has introduced a resolution to withdraw all U.S. troops within 365 days of its passage. Pacifica's Ann Garrison has more.
On March 28, Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz introduced a resolution to remove all U.S. troops from Somalia, in keeping with the 1973 War Powers Resolution and his vow to end forever wars. As with his recent resolution to withdraw all U.S. troops from Syria, he's forcing all 435 members of the House to go on record for or against another U.S. war with no end in sight. Here's Gaetz on his Firebrand podcast.
So in Congress, a War Powers Resolution is a privileged motion. And privileged motions were restored under the House Rules Package that I and a handful of other Republicans demanded as a feature of allowing Kevin McCarthy to ascend to the speakership. So the whole reason we're able to do this is because we're actually back to empowering the members. This means that the resolution on whether to withdraw U.S. troops from Somalia will skip committee and be brought to the House floor within 18 legislative days. That is how my legislation to withdraw troops from Syria was able to make it to the floor so quickly as well. You notice a trend. I am going to make these neocons in both parties vote to defend each and every place where we have troops, where we should not, where the goals are unclear, and where we are largely wasting the efforts of our military families and our service members, not because of anything they're doing wrong, but because the decision makers in Washington have far too often just delegated authority to the executive to decide where we engage in these misadventures and skirmishes all over the world. So why Somalia now? Well, the situation in Somalia is actually quite familiar. It's one more front in the globalist American empire's lineup of forever wars. For the past 16 years, think about that, 16 years in Somalia. So for 16 years, the United States has been involved in an advise and assist mission in Somalia. And throughout the mission that we've carried out, we've seen numerous operations and airstrikes within the country. Staying on brand for the warmongers of our time, former President Barack Obama utilized the 2001 authorization for force against Afghanistan to target al-Shabaab in Somalia. These strikes have been quietly conducted under the nose of the American public. By August 2022, a civilian harm watchdog group estimated that between 78 and 153 civilians had been killed by U.S. airstrikes in Somalia since 2007. It includes 20 to 23 children. The problem is, even under the best of intentions and the most focused of work of our brave service members, when we are killing civilians, we are not fighting terrorism. We are creating more terrorists. I noticed there's some disagreement with my perspective on Somalia on Facebook. Jeffrey said, well, there's ISIS in Somalia, so we have to be there. But the reality is, it's really an unsettled question whether or not us being there creates a downward pressure on terrorism or whether it is a recruiting tool for more terrorists. The hundreds of people we may have killed in Somalia who are innocent probably had family members, and I certainly hope we didn't radicalize those through misadventures. So sadly, our country's involvement in this war-torn country is not new. The lives of our troops have been carelessly gambled in Somalia for close to 30 years now.
That was Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz on his resolution to remove all U.S. troops from Somalia. Gaetz's nearly identical resolution to remove all U.S. troops from Syria failed, 103 votes to 321, with 47 Republicans voting yes, 171 no, while 56 Democrats voted yes, 150 no, and 11 congresspersons did not vote. The Democrats' House Progressive Caucus endorsed that resolution, but has not yet released a statement on whether it will endorse the current resolution to remove all U.S. troops from Somalia. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
The massive general strike in Israel and the shutdown of the country forced Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to temporarily halt a vote on a bill that would have allowed his party to dispense with the judiciary. Israelis in large numbers demanded democracy against Netanyahu. However, according to trade unionist Asaf Hadiv, who participated in the protests, there is no democracy without equality for Palestinians, and one state for all is the only real solution. Asaf Hadiv is a leader of the MAAN Workers Association, which represents Palestinian workers. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
So you've just returned from a demonstration against this effort by Netanyahu and his political faction to override the judiciary. It's a major political crisis, the biggest one that's happened in Israel before. Some have called it a police coup. What is going on in Israel?
Well, without a doubt, we have a dramatic situation, which yesterday, actually last night, was the peak of the crisis, especially in Tel Aviv, but also in other cities. Tens of thousands, up to 200,000 people, especially young people, went to the street after Netanyahu decided to dismiss the defense minister who opposed the legislation posed by the government. This was like a provocation. This was signified the responsibility and the adventurous character of this government. Not that the defense minister is an ex-general, he's a rightist, but this dismissal was really just a personification of the absolute disdain and contempt of Netanyahu and his government to any legal process, to any democratic procedures, the courts. Today, this morning, there was a press conference by all the leaders of the Israeli economy, banks, hospital managers, and the Histadrut, the major trade union, that refused to take, until today, after 3 months, they refused to take a position on the government. Today, they all sat together and decided to just to stop everything in the country. So we effectively, from the second they announced it, at 10 o'clock a.m. this morning, everything was just stopped, including the airport. So it was really some kind of show of force of the major parts of the Israeli economy, society, against the government and And Netanyahu had no choice. He had to give up, and he just half an hour ago, he made a press conference and said he's going to stop the legislation. Well, this is just sort of what we call the Hudna in our area. Hudna is the stop of the shooting in the war. It's not even a ceasefire, and it's absolutely not peace. We are at war, internal war, and it's important to understand that this is really a crisis inside Israeli society that is unprecedented, as you mentioned, Steve.
And for the Palestinian workers, your union has been fighting, representing them. The Histadrut, in their press conference, said that this is the first time that they've had unity with the employers. Is that true, that the Histadrut, and what is the Histadrut? Does it represent Palestinian workers in Israel?
Well, I want to say one more thing about the protest movement against the government and the rightist, sort of semi-fascist, very similar to Trump. You know, we're talking about people in the U.S. or listeners in the U.S. So you know, a government that is really went crazy, that lost any contact with life, that is speaking fake news all the time, that is just promoting ideas that are really out of any kind of relation to reality. This is the kind of government we have in a situation where, you know, the U.S. is a very strong country that was established more than 200 years ago. Israel is a relatively small country, divided completely between Israelis and Palestinians. It controls the West Bank in Gaza and Jerusalem militarily with repression and the occupation forces. It is a very, very sort of sensitive situation. And in this situation, that people like Ben-Gvir, fascist police minister, and Smotrich, the finance minister, and also partly defense minister, these people, extremist adventurists, are major or important part of the government. So the opposition to this government that was sort of concentrated for the last 3 months on the question of the legal reform that actually aims to demolish or to completely dismiss all the judicial, attorney general, that actually no any kind of intervention by legal people in the process, in the government. The government is able to do whatever it wants. Nobody will stop it. This is the aim of the reform. So the reform, it's a sort of legal coup. Is a lot more important, or let's say the significance of this movement, which is a movement of the Israeli Jewish section of the society, but it is actually going very deep against this kind of racist and the Jews only government that is typical to what Israel was, but it reached its climax with this kind of government. And this opposition, this very strong opposition, opens the way for a discussion, possibilities for defending and promoting equality between Israelis and Palestinians. And this is what we are fighting. I'm working in the framework of this union that called MAN, that Steve mentioned in the beginning. And I'm also a member of a political movement called Da'am, of Palestinians and Israelis who fight for one state, democratic state, for Israelis and Palestinians. And we believe that if until now it was very difficult for us to raise these ideas, these are relevant ideas to our crisis. Now, the Histadrut, to answer your question, the Histadrut has no any orientation toward Palestinian people, Palestinian workers, the Palestinian question. It is completely geared and accepts the general trend of Israeli, traditional Israeli policies that says that Palestinians are the enemy. They don't see Palestine and Palestinians as part of this community. We are in a country where Israelis and Palestinians live together, and we must find a way to live together.
And the AFL-CIO in the United States has a long relationship with the Histadrut. Randy Weingarten of the AFT has gone and visited them. Why is the AFL-CIO supporting the Histadrut, and do you think the Histadrut is a legitimate representative of the working class of Israel?
Well, by the way, Randy Weingarten and Steve Applebaum wrote an op-ed in Haaretz a month ago criticizing the Histadrut for not taking a position against Netanyahu and his rightist government. And this was really a very good article. So I think there's a lot of people, a lot of supporters of Israel in the U.S., including in the Democratic Party, including in the Jewish community in the U.S., that traditionally were for Israel no matter what. And there is like, I would say that this situation of today, this kind of alliance of Benjamin Netanyahu, which is supposedly a politician, very sort of experienced politician, his alliance with fascist, openly fascist forces, and the way that he gave them a very important post in the government is something that even supporters of Israel cannot swallow. And this is a very important situation. I think there is some declarations by a member of the U.S. Congress and U.S. Senate said the alliance between U.S. and Israel is not unconditional. If Israel goes the way that Hungary and Turkey and Russia went to, the U.S. would not support Israel. And this is, I think, it's a threshold. It's a point, very important point. I don't think the Histadrut is. They took a very important position today. I don't want to underestimate it, but they took it as a part of the their alliance with the Israeli business community. It was not a worker strike. It was a strike of the whole system of the economic institution in Israel. Politically speaking, I think they represent a very, very sort of center force in Israel. We need something democratic, trade unions, democratic movement that allows for Palestinians to be part of the scene, leadership part of the scene, not just, you know, supporters, but to lead the scene, to be part of one democratic movement of Israelis and Palestinians, and the Histadrut is very far away from it.
And the AFL-CIO as well is pro-capitalist. In fact, they're pro-imperialist. They support U.S. military operations around the world. There are 800 bases. But the rise of fascism in Israel, it's an international development. The fascist movement is growing around the world. One of the plans of the Israeli government, that new government, was the annexation of the West Bank. There is a, some have said that without democracy for the Palestinians, there will be no democracy for Jews. And you have said you support the one state. How is this new situation now going to raise this question of equality for all and the whole role, basically a state for Jews, but not for Palestinians?
Well, I think that the whole contradiction in this phrase of a Jewish and democratic state, and this is the characterization of the state of Israel, is a Jewish and democratic state. This is a contradiction. You cannot have a democratic state which is Jewish while you have a very important section of the population, which is Arab. On the spot, it puts those who are not Jewish into a second-class citizens. And if you want a democracy, it should be a democracy for the citizens of the country. And this contradiction was latent, was not didn't come up to fruition. And now when you have a government that actually says, we don't want democracy, we want Jewish country, Jewish state, Arabs have nothing here. This brings up to everybody the question, what is your position? Are you for democracy or are you for a Jewish country? And what you see, and this is very significant, you see many people saying, if a Jewish state means fascist state, I don't want to be part of this. I don't want to serve in the army of fascist state, even if it's Jewish, you know. I am Jewish, but I am not going to serve a fascist Jewish state. And this is very important. This is a change or a question that has not been discussed before. And people are saying, you know, liberals in Tel Aviv, these people who are demonstrating today, 200,000, 300,000 every Saturday, going out to the street, most of them never went to demonstrations. It's not old leftists. It's young people, also old people, but people who were sort of passive, sort of indifferent. They were not for the occupation, but they would not go out to demonstrate in the street for Palestinians. They are for the first time moving out and saying, we don't want to live in a country that is not democratic. Well, there is a big question of what is a future constitution of the state of Israel-Palestine or Palestine-Israel or a new name, you know, will look like. But for sure, it will have to be a new constitution, a new concept of how Israelis and Palestinians live together.
That was Asaf Adiv, one of the leaders of the Palestinian trade union, MAN, M-A-A-N, Workers Association, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Palestina by Orquesta Popular San Bomba. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Tampa Bay Students for a Democratic Society members, Gia Davila and Laura Rodriguez, were arrested along with two others during a peaceful protest on March 6th at the University of South Florida. The protest was to demand that USF President Raya Law commit to defending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the face of constant attacks by Governor Ron DeSantis and other state officials. Videos show officers brutalizing protesters and students, many of them women, who were slammed onto the ground and walls, placed in chokeholds, kicked, scratched, groped, and more. Gia and Laura are facing felony and misdemeanor charges. They have been banned from appearing on campus, putting Gia's academic future in limbo. The community has joined the effort to fight the charges and has demanded that the charges be dismissed. Hosts Ruth Beltran and Ali Abdulkader spoke with Gia and Laura on their show, The Ruthless Truth, on Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida.
On March 6th, we were having a protest for diversity on campus, especially with all of the attacks that have been coming from DeSantis. We wanted to meet with Raya Law, the school's president, to talk about diversity and make sure that our demands were met. And so our demands around DEI were that the College of the Arts and Sciences, which is like one of the biggest colleges at the school, have their DEI committee reinstated. We wanted the school to unpause their search for a diversity, equity, and inclusion vice president. After kind of some of the crackdowns from Ron DeSantis around DEI, we received an email from the school that they would be pausing their search for the vice president. So we wanted basically the school to make a public commitment or statement supporting DEI and saying that they're not going to let diversity programs close at our school.
And if I may add to that, SDS, since 2020, has had campaigns focused around particularly increasing Black enrollment at USF because it's super low. So the administration has known this entire time that we've been asking for greater diversity on our campus. And Gia can correct me if I'm wrong, but we've requested meetings in the past before that haven't been met.
That's exactly true. We've tried to meet with the president multiple times and, you know, never really received much of an answer. We kind of always get like the go around with her. She's the new president. So we've dealt with multiple presidents through this time. But we even made our demands clear at her inauguration when she promised that we would hear positive news surrounding Black enrollment soon. And then, you know, we never heard anything. In light of recent events, we're trying to get a meeting with her now to talk about, you know, what's going on in the brutalization of protesters, and she's still basically like refusing to meet with us. So,
right. I want to say that I know that y'all are very active on USF. You're constantly holding protests, making demands. So I was wondering if you could give us a breakdown on what happened on March 6th. How did the police arrest four people and break up this protest violently, this peaceful protest?
Sure. So basically, we were having a protest and a march. We wanted to meet with Raya Law to discuss diversity. So we marched into the lobby of the Patel Center on campus. And as soon as we got in there, it was just about 25 protesters holding signs saying, like, we want to meet with Raya Law. And then within the matter of like minutes, we were not in there for very long. The police started to grab protesters, pull them to the ground, throw them to the ground, assault people, and then they began arresting people.
Without warning either.
Yeah, they just without any warning.
Yes, I noticed that in the video that it was actually the chief of police that started this, right? That grabbed the first student without any warnings, as clearly stated in the video.
Yeah. And I also saw, I believe it was a lawyer on Twitter with the ACLU stating that he didn't believe that the cops had the right to initiate that violence because they were the ones that initiated that violence without any warning. They put their hands on protesters during a peaceful protest. I mean, that really says a lot about the state of the right of assembly here in Florida. But I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of the response of USF and of the police in the aftermath of that. I mean, four students were arrested. Could we talk about that?
I mean, the response has been incredibly disappointing from the police making up lies about what happened that day, which, you know, they can lie all they want, but the video doesn't lie. There's videos from multiple angles inside and outside the building that show cops brutalizing protesters. And so, you know, the cops came out and said, we threw water bottles at them, but in the videos, there's no evidence of any of these claims. And then basically, Raya Law came out with a statement that she didn't even send to students. She sent it to the press first, which just goes to show, like, not only can she not stand in support of students, but she knows her statement is so unpopular that she won't even say it to students. But basically, she came out and said, oh, after an internal investigation, you know, the protesters incited violence on campus, and basically said that we deserved what had happened to us, which is totally not true.
I've also heard that you've been suspended academically, several of the students who were arrested and can't return to the campus. Could you speak on that as well?
Yeah, so a huge part of what's been going on as well is not only are we having to face, first we face the physical brutalization from the police, then we face all of these legal charges that hold no grounds but are just putting us through all of this trouble. And on top of that, students and the staff member who was arrested are facing suspensions, academic and worker suspensions. So I have not been able to go on campus since we were arrested. I'm not allowed contact with any of my professors. The suspension was basically labeled as like temporary with no end date, kind of. So, you know, that's been like a whole nother stressor put on us. For me personally, I have 2 months before I graduate, and the school is putting me under the suspension that, you know, puts that at risk. And it's really scary to think of all of the time and the money that I've put into USF, studying, working hard, and to just see it potentially all go down the drain is horrible.
Yes, it is more than horrible. I just want to say that I'm very sorry that this happened to you. And I do want you to know that the local community stands with you. The local community, despite the propaganda on the media, like you mentioned earlier, the demands and what's happening with education here in the state of Florida are not popular. That's part of the reason why the president of your school is refusing to meet with students, but also that is the same thing outside of the school, outside of USF and throughout the state. What's happening is not popular and people do embrace DEI programs. And we want the schools to continue like they were before, not to cut back on important part of American history, which, you know, Black history is American history.
And where could our listeners find out more info on how to support the SDS and the four of you in this campaign?
It's just at Tampa Bay SDS on Instagram and Twitter as well. And we have a lot more information there about what happened and how to support people. So it's definitely the best place to go.
We just heard from Gia Davila and Laura Rodriguez in conversation with Ruth Beltran and Ali Abdelkader, hosts of WSLR's The Ruthless Truth. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the CRD Collective with production assistance from volunteers at WBPU Black Power 96.3 FM in St. Petersburg, Florida. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.